Dave Smith is an internationally recognized Buddhist meditation teacher, addiction treatment specialist, and a published author. He has extensive experience bringing meditative interventions into jails, prisons, youth detention centers, and addiction treatment facilities. Dave teaches residential meditation retreats and classes, provides trainings and consulting in both secular and Buddhist contexts. He recently founded the Secular Dharma Foundation, and he lives in Paonia, Colorado. I don't know if I'm saying that right, Dave. You can please correct me. But we're so excited to have Dave with us. So welcome, Dave.
Thank you, Renee. Yes, it's Paonia. You're pretty close. Paonia, Colorado, a huge town here of 1,800 people. And I'm very happy that I live here now. I was ahead of the curve. So happy to be here. I just want to say it's really, I'm very grateful and very happy to be teaching for Vinny Sangha. Vinny's an old dear friend of mine. I consider him one of my core teachers. And it's just really lovely to be here. I'm on Zoom often, and I have a lot more feelings in my body. Right now, a little bit of joy, a little bit of nervousness, a little bit of excitement. I normally don't have. Usually I'm just kind of doing the Zoom thing. And so to be with a big group of folks, and to be able to share some Dharma and talk about kind of what I've been up to is, very excited to see what happens, because I'm not entirely sure myself. So just to say a few words about how it's going to go down, is I'm just going to talk for about 10 minutes. I'm just going to do kind of an overview of what we're going to practice, what I'm going to talk about. And then we'll do a guided practice for about 30 minutes. And then I'll do a talk. And then at the end, we can have questions, maybe some answers, some reflections, or whatever you want to, however you want to spend that time is up to y'all. But to just to say that, you know, during the last couple of years since my COVID retreat, which I'm sure you're all on your COVID retreat. I hope your COVID retreat is going okay. Mine has been quite lovely, actually, because I haven't been traveling and I have a small children downstairs, and I've been home with my family. But what I've been studying and thinking about, and really had a lot of time to really do a lot of reading and a lot of reflecting, and really been able to study the Dharma in a way that I haven't in years, even though I have kids around, is talking about this term chitta vimutti, which is a Pali term. I'm a little bit of a Pali nerd and a junkie for early Buddhism, so you'll have to forgive me if I get technical at times. But I think it's good to know this stuff. And so when we think about chitta vimutti, what that really means is to liberate the heart. Chitta meaning like heart, mind. Vimutti meaning liberation. And so we are largely, I would say, Dharma practitioners in the game, in the process of trying to liberate ourselves from a whole wide range of things. And probably a little different for all of us. What I'm working on to liberate myself from might be different than you, and there's probably some universal overlap, and that's okay. The interesting thing about liberation through the heart is, if I actually think of one person who teaches this practice probably more, and really specifically whether he knows it or not, is Vinny. Vinny is the great teacher of chitta vimutti, the great teacher of liberation through opening the heart. And the reason I'm so interested in this is because I'm a lay person, or really what I would just say, a non-monastic person. And when you look at the early canon, when you look at really what was going on at the time of the Buddha, you find something that you maybe wouldn't assume. And that is that there were two Dharma paths. There was the path of monasticism, of, you know, taking the 227 precepts, joining the monastery, putting on the robes and doing all of that, which actually turned into the religion of Buddhism, which we know plenty about. And that's really, really what we only know about, frankly. But there was another path for people who were non-monastics that was very alive at the time of the Buddha, people who were farmers or people who made products, people who lived in the world, potters, artisans, people who made arrows and rope and all kinds of stuff, whatever they were making back then. A lot of what we call people or non-monastic people were practicing the Dharma. They were doing what I would say we're doing. But we don't know much about what happened, because that went away like at the time of the Buddha's death or soon after. So we don't actually have a good sense, a recorded sense of what a lay non-monastic Dharma path is like. Although now here we are, you know, almost 3,000 years later, all of us trying to kind of sort this out. So I spent the better half of the last 2 years really trying to understand this stuff. So I'm going to talk about that a little bit. And so the other way to think about this is usually when we think of liberation, the word that gets the higher level of attention is wisdom. We think about ourselves as liberating ourselves through wisdom, which is Panyavimutti, which is largely the monastic path, the path of restraint, we could say, the path of not engaging in money, not engaging in sexuality, not engaging in a whole range of hedonic worldly pleasure, you know, not eating past noon, and all this stuff that we, that I don't do. And so this really, this kind of path of restraint, which is kind of breaking through wisdom, which is this kind of idea that I think has haunted me for decades. And it's this idea you might be familiar with, is that we come to Dharma practice, we come to Buddhist practice, and we can kind of quickly get this sense that there's something that we don't know, right? There's something that Buddhism could offer us. There's something that we could know. And if we knew that, if we could just understand that, then we'd be able to not suffer anymore, that everything would make sense, and we'd be able to sort things out, which is kind of the promise, the end of suffering. And that's through some kind of understanding of things. Now, I have yet to find this myself. No lack of looking. Or there is this other way of looking at it, which is, I think, is what we're doing, is we're not really about restraint. We're about cultivation. At least that's what I'm about. I'm trying to cultivate. And so the word for meditation in early Buddhism is cultivate. So the practice of what I'm going to talk about largely tonight is metta bhavana, the cultivation of the Brahma Viharas as a cultivation, as a liberation practice in and of itself. And actually in the core teachings, metta bhavana and liberation through wisdom were both offered as totally verifiable paths to liberation. Over time, of course, the Brahma Viharas got a little downgraded as sort of being like not as stellar or as epic, if you will, as wisdom practice. But I think that a lot of that is changing now. People are starting to see these Brahma Viharas are really, they're really liberation practices. And I wanted to read this because I don't know a lot about Tibetan Buddhism, but there's some stuff in there that I think is great. And this comes from a 14th century Tibetan master who was one of the founders of the Nyingma school. I'm not going to say his name because I'm going to totally screw it up. But he wrote a book called The Tranquility of Finding Comfort and Ease. And for me, the word ease is the word that does the heavy lifting when I really try to think about what metta is, a sense of ease. And he writes here, he says, out of the soil of metta grows the beautiful bloom of compassion, to be watered by tears of joy under the cool shade of the tree of equanimity. And the Buddha also says about this in an early canon, there is no better mindfulness in this world, no better way to live in this world than a mind that is imbued with metta. So I love that image because it really points to this word cultivation, bhavana. That, you know, that really, like, and I look at my life, I feel like, you know, out of the soil of metta. And when we think about soil, if you've grown any fruit or done anything in a garden, the best soil is the soil that's stinky and gross and chicken poop and kind of nasty, right? Like, nothing grows in Malibu beach sand. And so I think that metta as a soil, it just includes everything. It includes everything we've been through, everything we are, everything that we have to deal with. And for those of us who have suffered a lot, we find that I feel like I have like totally like organic, grass-fed, organic, you know, free-range soil. The stinkiest of the stinky, and out of that grows the compassion and the mudita, the joy and the equanimity. And I think this creates a really great image for what this practice is really about for a lot of us. And so, really trying to see that, you know, in many ways, the Buddha doesn't seem actually all that interested in what you know. I don't think that the Dharma is a practice of knowing that. It's actually much rather a practice of knowing how. Do you know how? What kind of skills do you have? And so this really puts it more in the relational field, the cultivation field, the relationship I have to myself, to my world, to my children, to my political landscape, to all of to the world out there. And I have a not great relationship with the world sometimes, you know? So the practice that I want to do is a practice that's really a Brahma-Vihara practice that I learned from one of my first teachers. And the practice is really, it's Sila Brahma-Vihara, as the Burmese call it. It's really the cultivation of generosity and goodwill and the Brahma-Vihara. Because I think before we can even get into touch with the Brahma-Viharas and start to really cultivate these qualities, there really has to be an acknowledgement and understanding of sila, which is often translated as ethics, but really for me feels like a commitment or an integrity to my values. What kind of integrity do I have to kindness, compassion, gratitude, and equanimity? You know, I can't always rock those as much as I would like to. They don't always come so easy. So there's a recognition, and I think it's a really recognition. Actually, Vinny's done a talk on this before that I love. He has a talk called You Already Care. You already want to be a good person. You already have this like intentionality of non-harming, this intentionality of wanting to create positive change in the world, helping yourself, helping others. But for some reason, a lot of the people I talk to and work with, we don't include that in our measuring stick of how well our practice is going. You know, so we'll do a guided practice of this for about 30 minutes. So we'll go from Sila, which actually is a guided meditation. It's a meditation practice. It doesn't usually get taught as a meditation practice, which I find to be very odd that we don't sit and actually cultivate or attempt to cultivate a sense of goodness, right? So that, and then into the four Brahma-Viharas, and I'll hopefully leave plenty of space for some silence. And so you can sort of take a few moments to unhook from all of the thinking about the things that I've said. All right, everybody. Welcome back from wherever you just were. I'm sure you weren't here the whole time. That would be quite impossible. So thank you. One of my first teachers, really my first teacher ever, was a teacher named Stephen Smith, who was a teacher at IMS for many years, who's been in Asia for years, who I've been connecting with and talking to some in this recent time, used to always talk about Dharma practice as a beautiful relationship. And I really like that idea. It's not a word I hear a lot. People, we talk about relationships, but we very rarely use the word beautiful relationship. And, you know, when you look at the way that the mind is organized in the teachings on Abhidharma, which is the sort of treatise on Buddhist psychology, what are normally known as wholesome mental states, wholesome mental factors, they're actually called beautiful mental factors. And that we have this potential for this beautiful mind, this beautiful heart that can be developed. And so we could see that, you know, in a very modern sense, we could say Dharma practice is sort of this ethical technology of heart and mind, which is integrating this analog software of our body and our nervous system with this digital software of our mind and our awareness, and trying to integrate, which to me is really when you think about the Eightfold Path, the teachings on right concentration, I don't think the word concentration does quite the work, but this is really integrating. How do we integrate all this stuff into bringing it all together so that we can have this beautiful relationship with our heart and mind, which is probably going to take some work and it's probably going to take some time, but definitely worth it. One of my other teachers, Stephen Armstrong, used to always say, and I used to cringe when he would say it because I didn't believe it was true, but now I do believe it's true. And he would say, whether you are totally miserable and upset and suffering in your mind, having a terrible time, or whether you're totally thriving and doing well and having well-being, the effort is the same. It takes the same amount of effort. So how do you want to spend your time? You know, how do you want to spend your time in your mind? You know, one of the things the Buddha says that I love is this image of, he says that a tree that leans to the east will fall to the east. So as the tree grows and it starts to lean, it's leaning in a direction. And if it leans to the east, and that's where it will end up, that will ultimately fall. A tree that leans to the west will fall to the west. And so for me, the question is moment to moment, day by day, which way is my mind leaning? And I think part of the buy-in and part of the ask here is to trust that if we lean in the right direction, we will end up that way. The tree has to fall. The mind, the heart has to fall into the direction that it's leaning. And of course, this takes constant vigilance and effort to make sure that we're, you know, almost every other moment, there's a little bit of a leaning exercise. And we see this when we practice. So when we this word technology, the reason I use the word ethical technology is I think that in our culture, Dharma in America, for lack of a better word, which really is pretty new. This is pretty new. You know, I think we have to have, I try to forgive and remember some humility. Like we, you know, no one's been at this for all that long. So we don't actually have a really great roadmap for us non-monastic. Like, how do you do this, right? How do you live a Dharma-informed life in the world that we live in? Like, how do you do that? And I don't have no answers for you. I'll probably leave you with more questions than answers this evening, which I actually would prefer. But again, we've been really, really, and in my early practice in IMS, I sat in IMS a lot in the 90s, and it was very Sayadaw Upandita, lots of noting, lots of effort, lots of Vipassana, like trying to track moment to moment experience. And it was a lot of emphasis. And a lot of us, I think, get this sense that like, seeing things arise and pass away in and of itself is going to have some profound impact on us. And my argument in my long road of practice has taught me seeing is not enough. Seeing what arises in my mind is very, very helpful. And it's a great tool for liberation. But in and of itself, you know, doesn't really take me anywhere. It usually ends up just leaving me feeling a little bit frustrated and disappointed that I can't watch as good as I would like to. You know, I get lost in thought, I wander. And again, I think that this, one of the takeaways I think I'd like to leave you with that's been on my mind a lot is it's not about knowing that, it's about knowing how. So I'll just give a few examples of that. Like I know that, and you all probably know, you've probably heard at your first Dharma talk, we talked about this a little bit before we came on. We all know that things change, right? Impermanence, anicca, right? Pretty easy concept to understand intellectually. I know that. I believe that with a full 100% buy-in. I totally believe it. But when I'm faced with real change, in real loss, in real not getting what I want and things not going my way, very rarely does my mind pop up and say, oh yeah, impermanence again. No problem. So do I know how in the present context of my life when I'm up against real loss and real change, do I know how to relate to it in a way that's beautiful, that's kind, that's sometimes I do. Sometimes I get it, but a lot of times I don't. And this is like on the first page of the Dharma book that I read 30 years ago. Like this is basic stuff. You know, I also know that, and I believe wholeheartedly that compassion is the wise, beautiful, appropriate response to the hardship and the distress of my life. Totally buy it, 100%. But when I'm in real distress and I'm in real pain, or if I'm getting triggered into some old woundedness that's really old and kind of ugh, do I always bring compassion? Do I just call that right up to mind? I just ring that up and bring that up. Sometimes I do, sometimes I don't. It's a mixed bag. I do much more often now than I used to, so I can get us, my measuring stick is like, oh yeah, this happens more often than not, but I'm not always able to do it. The big one for me lately, because I live out in rural Colorado and I coach my kids' soccer game. My son's 9, so I coach the soccer team. So you get to meet all the other parents when you're the soccer coach, which is great because they cut you some slack because you're the soccer coach who's coaching the soccer team for free. So you get away with a little bit more. But, you know, you get in these kind of conversations around politics and vaccines and all this shit. And the question is, well, how kind can I be with the person right in front of me who's saying some things that I completely and totally do not agree with? Like very much don't agree with. How am I in that space? Where's the metta? Can I be friendly? And that's why I think when we think about metta, you've probably heard me use the word friendliness a lot. I think we really got to get away from this loving kindness. The Pali word for metta is mitta. When you know this word mitta, kalyana mitta, you know, spiritual friend, spiritual community, mitta, metta, same thing. It really means to be friends, to be friendly. And you know, and I like that because I can be friendly with everybody. I can't love or like everybody. That's, I'm not going to be able to do that. But I can be really friendly to people who I don't actually like or I don't agree with or I don't see things the same way. And if I do that, I walk away from the exchange feeling much better than if I made some smart little jab, some little educated, contemptuous little argument that I downloaded, you know, on into the experience to try to create some conflict and tension about how I'm right and they're wrong and the problem with the world is how they see things. And that's not going to do me any good, although that's really front and center most of the time. That's the thing that's like really wanting to come out. It's like, do I want to listen to that voice? The voice of I'm right and you're wrong, the voice of divisiveness. Do I really want to contribute to that right now? And you know, honestly, sometimes I do. Sometimes I lose. And I walk away going, oh man, I fucking can't believe I said that. God damn it. I'm going to have to clean this up at the next soccer game. Son of a bitch. It happens. So the other thing I want to get into a little bit, and I think this is a little bit technical, but I think it's important, and that is kind of the ongoing dilemma. There's kind of a debate that's been going on forever. And that basic question, so where does mindfulness fit into all this? Because, you know, the Buddha also does teach two paths to liberation, and the wisdom path to liberation is sort of outlined and well documented in Satipatthana, which is the Four Foundations of Mindfulness, which honestly, I love that book. I had to study it for years in my teacher's training, but it really has become the insight Bible. It's like, you know, the Pali Canon is 5,000 some odd pages. The Satipatthana Sutta is like 18 pages, right? It's like, but it's become the gold standard of what everything means, Satipatthana, which is the foundations of mindfulness, which is really kind of front and center. But the Buddha taught the foundations of mindfulness. He also taught the Brahma Viharas, and they both end up in the same place, right? The fourth Brahma Vihara is equanimity. The seventh awakening factor is equanimity. All roads lead to equanimity. And so the question becomes, and it is varying degrees, but I'll just tell you sort of where I find this to be helpful. And a lot of times the question is, mindfulness a wholesome mental factor? Is mindfulness a beautiful mental state? Some people think it is, some people think it's not. You get into the whole conversation around the mindful sniper and all these kind of distractions. But the thing I like about the Abhidharma, which I'll reference again because I really have gotten a lot of mileage out of that text, is it is understood to be a beautiful mental factor, in which there's actually 26 beautiful mental factors that all rise. So as soon as mindfulness, from the perspective of Abhidharma, once mindfulness is present, you're having access to all these, to kindness, to metta, to flexibility, to equanimity, to all of the kind of what I would call the sort of cash and prizes of Buddhist meditation, right? And so I think a lot of times we get into these binaries, right? And of course we know binaries in the world we live in right now, not helping. But you know, the big binary, I think, in Dharma practice that's really frustrating and has annoyed me is the path factors of being right. Right view, right intention, right speech. So there's right mindfulness and wrong mindfulness. It's like, is there anything in the middle? Is there like kind of right mindfulness? Or like, you know, these binaries are so intense. And so the first of all, I think we could just take the word right, sama is the term. We could just take it right out. We don't need it. If I'm going to come and talk to you guys about mindfulness, you're going to assume that I'm going to talk about a Buddhist perspective on mindfulness. I don't even need the word right. But really the word kind of means more actually like complete. Is that when mindfulness is complete. So a lot of times it's like, my path isn't complete. One of my teachers, though, I love Kamala Masters, who was married to Steve Armstrong for a long time, would always say when we make mistakes and we kind of don't always do well, say, my path isn't finished. I'm not done. There's actually no done either, right? Let's be honest. There's no such thing as done in this work. But there's that sense of like, yeah, like, so we start to notice with mindfulness, we start to get access to these better qualities of being. So, you know, being aware of what's going on in mindfulness from a Buddhist perspective, they're actually pretty different. I think mindfulness, and I don't know if it's true, but I choose to believe and I prefer to believe that mindfulness is a beautiful state of mind that acknowledges it, that bears in mind. That's really what mindfulness means. It bears in mind. Can I bear in mind the sense of goodness? Can I bear in mind my sense of integrity? Can I, in these Brahma-Vihara practices, which I think, another thing that I think is problematic that I've kind of been frustrated with for years, is they oftentimes on insight retreats, they teach them as concentration practices. And I don't think they're concentration practices. I mean, saying the phrases over and over again can give you some concentration for sure, but I think that really, really does not do the heavy lifting in the game of liberation. They're insight practices, right? They're insight. They're giving us insight into our inner experience, this nonverbal experience. And I think that we forget that because, like, if we look at human evolution, thinking's pretty new. Like, language is kind of a recent invention in the history of humankind. Like, we haven't been speaking in languages. We don't even know we don't even really know what language the Buddha spoke, and everything was recorded in Pali, but we don't. When the Buddha was talking, we don't really actually know how he was communicating. So, and I don't know about you, but when I think in English, because that's the only language I know. And, you know, so we forget that we actually do have an emotional, nonverbal, embodied, innate, ancient awareness that much of our Dharma practice is trying to get down into the analog. And I think largely the Brahma-Viharas are really in the analog. They're in the nonverbal. And, you know, I've been sitting insight retreats for years, and I've been teaching meditation retreats for years, and I can tell you, rarely do I find a student or have a conversation with somebody who had some big insight or some life-changing experience through the teachings of Anatta or Not Self, through the 12 links of dependent origination, or through any of these esoteric big kind of intellectual ideas, or mindfulness of breathing, or that's some liberation through understanding Vedana. People have the liberation that I've seen, that I've felt, is through, I had this feeling in the sense that I actually love myself. I've had the feeling in the sense that I actually care about myself. That most of the big kind of insights, that's why I think they're insight practices, they come through these kind of deep, what was a nonverbal experience becomes available into the mind, into the thoughts, into meaning, into understanding. It's like, oh, wait a minute, I really do love myself. I really do care about myself. I can really be friendly to this thing I did years ago, or I can be kind and compassionate for some of this horrible shit that happened when I was a kid. I can liberate myself from those karmic knots, those karmic wounds. And that usually doesn't happen through like getting good at mindfulness of breathing. It usually happens in this chitta vimutti. It usually, and you've probably, many of you, if you've been on retreat with Vinny, for sure you've had these experiences. You know, you sit through one of his heart practice sessions. You know, I remember when I would sit against his dream retreats early back in the day, it's like, you know, Vinny would walk out of the room out of a compassion or forgiveness practice and half the room would be in tears. You know, because people are having an understanding and insight into like, oh, there's something going on here that I just have never seen or felt before. And man, I would like more. And that's really the way this chitta vimutti, sila brahma vihara, or what I would actually call metta vipassana practice, starts to get some more, it's a much more active practice. It's not Vipassana, kind of dry observing of kind of the objects arising and passing, right? We need some of that for sure. But when we look at the kind of liberation process, especially mapped out like through Mahasi Sayadaw or the progress of insight, and my feeling and my opinion and my experience has been when it comes to meditation technique, the Sayadaws of Burma have really figured it out. I mean, they have exhaustively tracked present time experience in ways that's just phenomenal. And so that we recognition, mindfulness, the first stage is recognition. We can recognize the mind as a mental event. We can recognize the mind as a kind of experience that's happening. We can see the hindrances. We can see craving. We can see aversion. We can see hatred. We can start to recognize the arriving of these kind of phenomenon more clearly, right? But that's like the first, like there's a lot more work to do from there. Because I remember sitting in my early 20s at IMS being like, yeah, I can see the hatred. I can see the fear. I can see all this stuff. But seeing it isn't doing anything. It's actually just making me more frustrated. It's actually making me not want to fucking practice. Because if this is what I'm going to be looking at while I'm sitting here, I'll just go back to the world of distractions and alcohol and TV and entertainment. Like, if this is what Dharma's about, then fucking count me out. I don't want to see all this. You probably, I would imagine, you know what I'm talking about to some degree. And so from there, we try to see this stuff. And then we have to begin to understand and feel into the relationship that we're having with what's going on. And then again, we see another layer of things that are not pretty or not, we're not happy to admit. We see that there's stuff going on that I hate. I hate this. I feel ashamed about this. I really, really want this, but I don't feel like I deserve it. And then we start to see we have this insanely complicated, probably not beautiful relationship with our experience. And we get into this tricky, crazy business of trying to selectively numb. And we think that the practice is to cultivate all the good stuff and to get rid of all the bad stuff. And then everything will be fine. Which is ironic because the entire practice of Dharma is trying to break us from that very core habit to begin with. Right. So it gets messy pretty quick. But part of it, and I think one of the things that we learn, and there is some benefit in the sort of just dry watching, because some of the things that happens is if we stay in it for a while, and it worked for me because I stayed in it for a while, because I knew there was something here that was worth it. And I would clock those 10-day retreats in the 90s, one after another, and like 90% of it would be horrible. But there'd be that one little sit or that one experience or that one Dharma talk. I'd be like, okay, I'll come back next year. And that's kind of how we get. So, you know, we get some tolerance. We get some general tolerance, which is an aspect of metta, where we know it's going to happen, but we can tolerate it. We also get a little bit of acceptance. We also get even some confidence, which are all, again, part of these beautiful mental factors. Confidence or faith is considered a beautiful mental factor. Tolerance is an aspect of metta. We get these things, so we start to be able to cook it a little bit more. But I think when we start to, and this is, I think, the transformation practice. And I think when people think of Buddhist meditation as transcendence, I think that's a big problem. And I think that and it's happened to me, I think when we get into crazy later terms like enlightenment and transcendence, this idea that we're going to somehow be above it all, that we're going to divorce the digital from the analog, and we're not going to have to deal with the feelings and the emotions and the nonverbal and the somaticized body stuff. Be nice. It's a great, looks good on a brochure, you know, but in reality, I don't think it's very realistic. So the transformation has to happen before the transcendence. And that transformation, I think a lot of it, and you've probably been doing this a long time, is to recognize these parts of our experience, to actually see what the relationship is and be like, okay, like there's parts of me that is a very unhealthy, actually even borderline abusive relationship. You know, and so seeing that a lot of times is painful, but then I can start to bring metta to that and say, okay, well, you know, this is a human experience. Shame is a human universal emotion. You know, everybody has this. That's what's great about community. That's what's great about sharing with people at the end of a retreat. You start to realize everybody's totally fucked up. It doesn't really matter because we think we're the only ones, right? I'm like, I remember sitting there and be like, man, if anybody in this retreat could be inside my mind right now, they'd call the state police. They would call the Massachusetts State Police and they would come down here and they would yank me out of the meditation hall. You know, violence and fear and confusion and just wanting to, you know, take a bazooka to the meditation bell in the front of the room. Somebody better ring that fucking bell or I'm going to go bananas. You know, just hanging in there as best as I can, you know. And then we start to take the Brahmavihara practices seriously and say, okay, like it gets to the point where like we get to the point, and you probably get there, we get so backed up to the wall, we're like, kindness is really the only thing that's going to help here. And that might be, you know, kindness is, there's lots of words that are in the family of metta kindness. We could say acceptance might be part of that. A friendliness might be a part of that. A permission, like allowing this part of myself to be here might be part of that. And one of the things I think that's, I don't know what to say, it's kind of a drag, I guess I would say, about the greater mindfulness meditation world and the Dharma world in general. And I have the benefit of, you know, working with lots of students and meeting lots of people, and I've traveled around the country before COVID. And one of the things I generally hear about metta practices is basically what I heard is that people just don't do them. You know, people at best have like a mindfulness practice that they sort of practice maybe 4 or 5 days a week. And when you ask, what about metta or even compassion or gratitude? You usually hear people say, well, yeah, I was on this retreat last summer and we did like this metta thing in the afternoon on Tuesday. It was really good. I was like, oh, really? You just got it, huh? That was it? Like, yeah. It's like, I got it and moved on. I fall into that delusion. I'm like, yeah, I did that. Like, I have this whole part of my delusion as I have this I'm all better now bullshit story I tell myself. I'm like, oh, yeah, I did that. Oh, forgiveness. Oh, yeah, I totally did that. I'm done. I'm finished. Right? We want to be finished. I want to be finished with a lot of this stuff, I'll be honest with you. So we keeping an eye on time here. So just lastly, I want to say, and you can take with this what you will, is the question here quickly becomes, well, where, and this has been a question I've been asking myself for years, four foundations of mindfulness, where are the Brahmaviharas in the Satipatthana? They're clearly not in there. And why are they not in there? And if they were in there, where would they be? And I'll tell you what I think and how I practice it. And I found it to be tremendously beneficial. And the probably the most confusing part of Satipatthana is what's called the fourth foundation of mindfulness, or mindfulness of dhammas, which there's five categories. You have the aggregates, the sense spheres, the hindrances, the awakening factors, and the Four Noble Truths. And when you look at, when they do a kind of academic survey of all the different versions of Satipatthana, what they find in all of them is you have the hindrances, the awakening factors are usually in all of them. And the awakening factors, again, have been elevated to sort of a status of like the seven awakening factors are like how you wake up. And it's like mindfulness to equanimity. And there's a bunch of other ones that I don't even have to memorize because seven is too many things to remember, frankly. But if we put the Brahmaviharas in the foundations of mindfulness, I believe, and I experience them, they are in the fourth foundation of mindfulness. And what they are, in a colloquial sense, is their relational mindfulness practices. And I would just add mindfulness to the list. So you have mindfulness in the awakening factors, or you have mindfulness in the Brahmavihara practices. And so it's my relationship to my experience is really what I'm learning in the fourth foundation. The fourth foundation is linked to the Eightfold Path. It's cultivation. The fourth foundation of mindfulness is really about the active side of my mind. And it's trying to see and to perceive with a sense of kindness, with a sense of compassion, with a sense of gratitude, with a sense of equanimity. And you can practice them thus. And in many ways, the practice we did earlier is a fourth foundation of mindfulness practice, where we're using, actively using the Brahmaviharas and mindfulness as an actual cultivation mechanism for liberation. No small thing. And so, and I've had many annoying kind of, for some people, boring to some people, conversations with Buddhist academics about this. And I have gotten the thumbs up from many a people about really, that's really where they go. Their relational mindfulness practices, they can be seen as a standing side by side to the awakening factors. Mindfulness in the Brahmaviharas will lead you to equanimity. Mindfulness in the awakening factors will lead you to equanimity. Everything's going in the same place. Now, of course, I like to do both, right? Why not double dip and really try to see these as mutually exclusive? So they're cultivation practices. And I have found them I mean, I can't even tell you the seven awakening factors is how interested I am in they, and they are. And I can give you the 52 mental factors of the Abhidharma. So I don't know what it is my problem with this list is, but I just find that it doesn't have a lot of application to real world. I can go to the grocery store and do a fourth foundation practice on the Brahma Viharas. I can just totally see, like, who am I judging? Who am I pushing away? Who am I dismissive for? What people do I have a sense of compassion? So sometimes I see people and I have a sense of, I feel warmth towards them, or I feel defensive towards them. So you can just be always clocking these practices. What is the relationship to this aspect of my experience? Right. And then the mindfulness is working well, the recognition, well, I really don't like this and I want that to go away. It's like, okay, cool. How does that feel? Oh, that doesn't feel so good. Aversion not doesn't feel so good. The hindrances, they disturb the mind. So this just is my offering for y'all this evening. I want to take some time, and I'll hang on a little bit longer, on Chitta Vimutti. As a path of liberation in of itself. So any questions that you have, I don't know if Renee, you're going to drive a little bit, or how many questions there are. I haven't been on Zoom with this many people in a long time, so you got to cut me some slack.